The Sunstone Foundation presents Franchising the Faith, the evolution of the ward as a community, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
But even as late as 1940, some rather interesting buildings were being completed that allowed for stained glass windows, mosaics, frescoes, and sculpture, which provided them with a certain identity of their own. But the real shift occurred in the responsibility and calling of the bishop, who was now responsible for both spiritual and temporal well-being of the membership. Also, the goal of the church in general shifted from promoting the kingdom of God in a promised land to a rapidly expanding church in the nation and even the world. The concept of the Mormon village was now of another era. Many creative innovations in church auxiliaries were instituted during this period. The Relief Society, NOA, Sunday School, etc., had to adjust to the new urban setting, and many concepts that worked well in the wards were accepted by the general church leadership and then recommended as church-wide programs. In other words, during this period, there was a filtering up of ideas from the local communities. Of course, the Depression of the 30s brought into focus the problem of living separated from the land and its accompanying life support. The Mormon village had been abandoned, and no alternative survival strategy had filled the void. Of course, the concept of the welfare plan, developed first by Harold B. Lee and the Pioneer Stake, filtered up to the top and became a general church program. Although the program didn't have time to fully respond to the needs of the Depression, it was an extremely creative effort. Unfortunately, the stake rather than the ward was assigned its management. And of course, the stake does not have the dynamic energy of the ward. But the main point here is that it again was a program developed at the grassroots by local initiative. Also, and of equal importance, is that the church again assumed the obligation to assist in the temporal well-being of its members. Urban territorial ward made a reasonably successful transition from the rural setting to the new urban environment. The territory that the ward served remained fixed. The ward building retained a strong community identity, and the community itself retained a limited self-determination. An interesting thing happened during this period, and it's hard to find out exactly when it happened, but sometime during this period, the idea of the budget came into being. And what the central church was saying is, the budget is yours, tithing is ours. And that was a big change. After the war and the great immigration of members from Europe, church leaders began to think of the church as a world organization. The World Church Ward, now this covers a period from 1950 to 1975. During this period, perhaps the most radical changes occurred, and for good reason. Managing a world church required a vast bureaucratic expansion. It was rather paradoxical to observe church leaders who detested the central bureaucratic control of government and labeled this direction as a socialistic evil do precisely the same thing by assuming total control of the wards through bureaucratic processes. Well, unfortunately, this was accomplished with scarcely a whimper from the local community. To begin with, the church in Utah was no longer the model for the rest of the world, but rather had to adjust to a new model that could be replicated with ease throughout the world. The one exception was that the church in the United States had to pay its own way, while the foreign church received a heavy subsidy. Because it required a ward in the United States to carry its own costs as well as that of a ward in another country, there were indefinite adjustments. The very simple economic solution to this problem was that wards were forced to abandon their territorial identity, and the practice of two or three wards using the same building became standard. The financial burden of building new churches for the vastly expanding church population was cut in half and thereby made manageable. Because of the territorial attachment of some congregations to their building, the central church took over the ownership of all church buildings. At this point, the ward ceased being a community in a classic sense. It had no self-determination, no defined territory, but functioned as a unit of the central church, an outlet, a franchised operation. No longer was the typical Mormon congregation afforded the same rights and powers of any Protestant congregation. The folksy, loving relationship between the central church and the local church was lost. The church leadership was cut off, isolated by the expanding bureaucracy, and began to develop more rigid controls and programs in order to make their managerial task more comprehensible. The new bureaucracy carried out its responsibility with such cold efficiency that members used to the older methods were often horrified. The money collecting and distributing tasks were computerized before many large corporations had applied the new technology. The church building committee became very efficient at cost controls by simply disregarding any recommendations from the local congregation. Ward boundaries are now shifted so often, and since three congregations use the same building, the central church had to become the client, rather than the nebulous, ill-defined congregation to be served. During this period, church architecture continued its deterioration with the construction of bland ward buildings, but often bizarre temples, totally void of any semblance to the long-evolving traditions of Christian architecture. Because of the rather tenuous relationship of the central church to the local church leaders had to be chosen on the basis of their capacity to respond to the dictates of higher authority. Programs, methods, and systems emanating from the central church were applied whether they worked or not. Once they were given a special designation as inspired, they were integrated into the system with a mindless obedience. Two-way communication ceased. The central church issued its edicts and the local church responded. The typical complaint of dull manuals is a good example. No one at the top seems to listen or, for that matter, care. The final blow for the now beleaguered ward was the complete turnabout of the long-held commitment of the church to assume responsibility for the temporal well-being of the members. A revolutionary change in the welfare plan was instituted, and again for good reason. Since half the church was already carrying the financial burden of the other half, the added burden of subsidizing welfare would have been intolerable. The new position taken by the central church was that the family must assume the obligation of caring for the temporal needs of the members. The church welfare plan was to be used only as a backup for more extreme cases. The leadership had come to the realization during the recession in the mid-70s that church welfare could not care for more than 3% of the membership. It was also clear that the welfare plan could not expand fast enough to handle the needs of the rapidly increasing membership. The welfare plan at that point in time became an extremely well-managed and proficient charity, now removed from the stake and managed by the region. The obligation of the central church to the individual member was reduced significantly. Yes, welfare was still available, but it was now almost as remote as government assistance. But somehow, through all the aforementioned changes, the ward, this extraordinary human institution, retained its life. And although some of its vitality was drained off, dried up, there was still some remaining magic. The corporate correlated church, now this covers the period from 1975 to 1985. The ultimate realization of bureaucratic control came in the form of correlation. Church leadership separated now from the reality of how wards did in fact function, and the human qualities of those it was meant to serve, idealized the membership beyond reality, and then instituted such rigid programs that church participation became a monotonous burden. Consolidation of church meetings and then correlation of teaching materials created an atmosphere in the anonymous ward building that was and is void of enthusiasm. This robotization of procedures finds the average member proceeding through his religious obligations by the numbers, in a hurry to get it over with, and then flee to something more satisfying. Communal interaction has been reduced to a minimum. After 3 hours of meetings, the members are too nervous and exhausted to interact. Young children are being conditioned that Sundays have 3 hours of tedious boredom, and that for some obscure reason must be endured. A vital local community would never institute a 3-hour meeting for anyone, let alone young children. Only planners remote from the institution served could hope for positive results. But even after the onslaught from the central church, this extraordinary community miraculously retained some vitality. The question then becomes, how long can community be sustained on 3 hours a week in a building with no community identity grinding through the required programs which few, if any, enjoy. How unfortunate that this ingenious, inspired concept is no longer allowed to be a community in the full sense. We send our missionaries to convert people to the faith, but we must remember that the Lord is the physical embodiment in the faith. If this singular direction, this mindless reductionism is allowed to continue, soon, as Gertrude Stein said, there is no there. As it is, there is less and less and less. What are the basic requirements for a valid community? For unless they are present, true community cannot exist. First, there must be self-determination, or the right for the local community to decide on what is best for it, what things can enhance its condition. A community must not be required to respond to rigid programs established by remote planners. Goals can be set from a distance, but the means and methods of achieving these goals must be the result of local initiative and even local inspiration. For it is often local inspiration, insight, creativity that eventually produces the exciting idea, the breakthrough. The local community must have control over its resources, or those elements critical to its survival. These physical, human, and financial resources must be available to respond to immediate community needs first. A community that cannot finance its own operation can never be a community. The condition of half the church carrying the financial burden of the other half is unnatural, unbalanced. The wards in Latin America must become financially self-sufficient. The wards in both the United States and the rest of the world must be given the freedom to discover new means and methods for achieving them. Two, the community must have the commitment of its members, and this commitment must be self-generated. A shared faith in the binding myth is not enough, particularly in a time when newly discovered accounts seem to be qualifying the myth. But the myth will stand. The critical additional dimension is the joy, the celebration of being part of something exciting, fulfilling, or working on the edge of discovery in a dynamic community committed to human progress, and it is willing to go wherever that leads. The glory of God is intelligence. Man is that he might have joy. These are exciting concepts that often seem forgotten. Community gatherings cannot be restricted to once a week, nor can the main Sunday meeting be so filled with busy repetition that no time is allowed for members to get to know each other and then to discuss the real needs of the community. In most contemporary religious organizations, either before or after church, the members gather at a kind of reception where light refreshments are served and people have the opportunity for fellowship. I believe this is an excellent idea. With a new consolidated schedule, visiting has deteriorated. Members suffering from an overload have no choice but to flee. Children experience few, if any, rewards unless they are programmed through negative reinforcement. I would suggest that if the wards were given the freedom of accomplishing certain things each Sunday, they would quickly resolve a more satisfactory, even enjoyable solution that would make more sense. Three, the community must have a defined territory. It must be a special place, a holy place, where many of the most important matters of life are accomplished. The community must be able to feel a great sense of place, identity. This can never be accomplished in a building owned by a remote institution that is corporate clean, corporate barren, corporate anonymous, shared with other congregations without the slightest hint of who inhabits the space. Great religious architecture is the ultimate community architecture, for it has been the product of many generations, contributing their own additions and embellishments, thus creating a great sense of place and history. Early Mormon ward buildings achieved this with a strong design to begin with, but added were stained glass windows, frescoes, mosaics, paintings, sculptures. Music was composed, hymns written. It was a culture that was alive, always reaching. Unfortunately, that is far from describing the condition today. Four, a community achieves its validity through the commitment of its members to each other. The member donates to the community in turn obligates itself to the member. A community is a cooperative, a sharing of burdens. And that was true of the classic Christian community of the New Testament, as it was true of the early Mormon community. It's unfortunate that the stake rather than the ward was chosen to implement the goals of the welfare plan. If the ward had been chosen, it would have provided a vastly improved condition for its success. There are other elements that could and should be discussed here, but there isn't time. I hope that no one has been defended. I also hope that no one feels that the paper has been critical for the sake of being critical. Also, paper does not suggest that the same idealized reversion of the past is a solution. Times change, needs change, solutions change. Of prime importance is that we realize that the Lord is an extraordinary human institution with incredible potential, a potential we do not yet begin to understand, and that with the freedom to search out these possibilities, extraordinary things could be realized. Ashley Montague, an eminent anthropologist, insists that the evolutionary progress of the species came not necessarily through the survival of the fittest, namely the strongest and most intelligent, but rather through the collective strength of an intelligent community. Man's capacity to cooperate and the strength derived therefrom cannot be overestimated. In a world of self-centered materialism, which clearly has not been an optimum environment for nuclear families, the magic of a cooperative institution like the ward and its inherent benefits to the family should be given every possibility to develop to its full potential. In conclusion, then, I would suggest that although there is great inspiration at the top, there is also highly significant inspiration at the bottom. And as we obligate ourselves to follow those who lead, they too are obligated to listen to those who follow. For in the final sense, the community belongs to the world. Thank you.
Let me say that, in a certain, in a kind of strange sort of way, Sunstone was right when it asked me to respond to your paper, in that, in the first place, I'm neither an anthropologist nor a sociologist, nor a historian of Mormonism, for that matter. I do history of ideas and philosophy of religion. And kind of in a strange way, in the second place, although I can sympathize with a lot of Mr. Mullen's objections to the contemporary ward, and, you know, because anyone who experiences the problems of living with other people would have to. But back to why I think it was a good choice is that there couldn't be two people who disagreed with each other more than me and Mr. Mullen. And so what I have to say, even if it isn't enlightening, at least it may be entertaining because there's going to be a good contrast developed. One of the things that they would have done better in asking my wife actually to respond to this paper, because I stole most of my material from her, her work on Mormonism and popular religion. Okay. First, I want to explain what I'm going to do. Because I'm anything but an expert in this field, I'm going to start with just some personal reflections on my experience of being a member of a ward in Toronto, Canada, and then propose an alternate view of what community is to that that Mr. Mullen presented. Okay. I want to start first, though, by reading a quote from Martin Buber that I think will be immediately applicable to what we've been talking about today. It's from Buber's article, Dialogue, that is found in his book, Between Man and Man. Okay. No factory and no office is so abandoned by creation or the possibility, for Buber, it's the possibility for human beings to form community together, to enter into a meaningful relationship with each other. no factory and no office is so abandoned by creation. What I'm going to essentially talk about in this is the magic, the remaining magic that Mr. Olin spoke about in his paper. Start again. Okay, no factory and no office is so abandoned by creation that a creative glance could not fly up from one working place to another, from desk to desk, a sober and brotherly glance which guarantees the reality of creation, of the creation which is happening. And nothing is so valuable in such an unsentimental than such an unsentimental and unreserved exchange of glances between two men in an alien place. Goes on to say that no place, no dehumanized factory, or in this case Mormon ward, if indeed that is the case, is beyond redemption, is beyond turning in our abilities to turn it into a community experience if we bring ourselves to that place. I would say that part of Gertrude Stein's problem when she went to Oakland and said there is no there, is that there might have been a there for some of the people living in Oakland, but Gertrude Stein wasn't really willing to go out there in that gosh-awful, you know, suburb and find the there with those people. Okay, I'm going to start out with first some generally experiences that I had in my ward in Toronto, and use them as specific disagreements I had with some of the things that Mr. Mullen said in his paper. First of all, this doesn't have to do with what I had with what happened to me in Toronto, but I know the paper was largely on personal expression, personal experiences and personal impressions of what is going on in the world, but one of the problems of the paper was there was no documentation. There were some really sweeping generalizations made about the evolution of the Mormon ward, and I'm not in a position to say whether they were right or wrong, but documentation would have been essential in order to verify or be able to check whether the assertions made were correct or not. One of the things that comes out of this is something that seems to often happen at Sunstone conferences, is we view the past as a sort of golden age. There was true community then, but now, it's impossible. As the French philosopher Gabriel Marcel would suggest, the idea of a golden age seems to be more of a structure of the mind, not so much implying what was, as to what could be. We experience the radical kind of disrelation between the real and the ideal. And we reflect back to a golden age in which things seem to be together. The second objection I had was the idea, and this, I think, is a really profound objection that I have to the paper, is the idea that a ward would have to achieve financial independence in order for a community to exist. In my experience in an inner-city ward in Toronto, I could find nothing as being so foreign, so far from being the case. My ward in Toronto was made up of people who were poor, who... the idea of them carrying the, half the people in the war were on church welfare. But the idea of them being able to carry the load that Mr. Mullen would say would be necessary for them to form a community is absolutely impossible. I would go on from that to say that it would be absolutely impossible for us to expect the Latin American churches, the churches in third world areas, be able to do the same. And contrary to the case, in the ward that I lived in Toronto, Canada, that, an inner city ward, there was probably a more profound experience of community than any place that I've ever been. And the reason for this, I would say, would be the common symbols that we held together. This you know, in this sense, I think it's wrong to compare the ideal condition of the Mormon ward with the Protestant congregation. The Mormon ward is much closer to an idea of a strong symbol at the top of the church like that of the prophet. I think it would be much closer if we were to compare Mormonism with Catholics. Or, you know, to go on beyond that, to compare them even with Muslims, with their pilgrimage spots, where the shared symbol is not a person, but is a place. A good example of this is the pilgrimage that brings together, you know, you could say this in Catholicism too, that brings together people from diverse economic backgrounds and brings them to the Alcabá, or brings a Catholic to Rome, or to the site where the bones of a particular saint are. You only have to think of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, which a diverse background with no prior relationship to each other are brought into a very tight community experience because of a shared symbol. I think you could go on from this to say that the experience that most of us have going to the temple, although, you know, I would agree with Mr. Mullen that I feel better when I go to Salt Lake or Manti than I do when I go to Provo, but still, there's that experience of a kind of unity with those people. When you're sitting in the rite, going through what a Mormon takes to be the meaning of his existence. And this is what I found in Toronto. The people there who had extremely mundane jobs that were what we would call the personalizing, brought meaning into their life by thinking that here on Sunday, even though we're meeting in a three-hour period, which was a lot easier for people in Toronto because you would have to, nobody owned a car. Well, some people did, but many people didn't because they weren't financially that well off. It was a lot easier for them to come to a three-hour meeting in the morning than to go home in the afternoon and come back again. But the main point is that they interpreted their life by the powerful symbols that were given to them by the church. They were participating in the kingdom of God. And that was the bedrock that created the community. Not the fact that they owned the meeting house. Not the fact that they were financially independent, because they were not. Okay. Just a couple of other points. Children and boredom. I don't think this is a new thing. I remember when I was a kid growing up in Taylorsville, Utah, sitting in sacrament meeting and trying to make my fingers create the smallest hole possible so I could still see the head of the speaker, because the meeting was so incredibly boring that I couldn't, you know, imagine having to sit there for an hour and a half. I think there still is meaning provided, though, for kids in Sunday school, because my children seem to think there is. Another thing, point that I just have to say is that the manuals may be in some ways monotonous, but I don't think they have to be. Because if you look at the priesthood manual, what is it? It's a list of scriptures. You know, and in some ways that gives us a good deal more independence to interpret our religion than, say, the classic manuals that we used to get from B.H. Roberts and Talmage did. There was a kind of intellectual slavery involved there, because you had this powerful mind telling you what to believe. And because of that, and there were some rather bad implications for that, the way that some of us perceived the church afterward, that it was a rational thing, that you could prove it rationally. And I think they're in some ways a darn sight better than the ones we had in the 50s and 60s, which were largely informed by the social gospel, and some of those in the early 70s that seemed to give a social scientific explanation for everything that was going on. For example, the five steps to prayer. If you wanted to get in touch with God, you would go through these five steps. Those weren't written by committee. Although, you know, there are disadvantages. I find the manual somewhat less offensive nowadays, because you just read the scriptures. They're just lists, like in Catholic devotional things, of scriptures to read for that day. Okay. Now, I'd like to move on to the more theoretical part of my response, which I'm going to rely on Martin Buber and Gabriel Marcel, Victor Turner and Henri Bergson. Okay. Buber, again, talks about an idea of community, which is an essential relation between an I and a thou, or between what he calls the essential we. And what it is when a person, for Buber, can approach the world in two ways. You can approach it in an I-thou relation. You can treat other human beings as human beings, you can be open to them, or you can approach them as things, as means to an end. By the way, both of these ways are necessary in our general comportment in the world. It's just which one is appropriate at which time. In I and Thou, he writes, talking about the essential community, the we includes the thou. Only men who are capable of truly saying thou to one another can truly say we to one another. No particular kind of group formation as such can be adduced as an example of the essential we, but in many of them, the variety which is favorable to the arising we can be seen, the essential we, the community, can be seen clearly enough. It is enough if a single man is accepted who is greedy of power and who uses others as means to his own end and who craves importance and makes a show of himself to destroy the essential we. So in a sense, what Buber is saying, what destroys the essential community is when people of that community withhold themselves from participation. I'm not saying that, I'm not saying blind obedience or blind following along, but from some sort of participation in that community, akin to something that Eugene Ingram said today, that even with all the problems, we have to immerse ourselves in it and try and create new and better forms. This goes along with what Mr. Mullen said. I'm going to drop a proportion of my remarks because I'm going to go over time. This is where I was going to talk about the difference between scientific and religious assertions and talk about how religious assertions are tied to depth experiences, like the experience of community. But I'm going to drop that and move on to the idea of closed and open communities. Well, not communities, but closed and open society, as they're found in Henri Bergson and Victor Turner. Going back to the notion of pilgrimage here, that a community is created not just from a state of affairs, but from when human beings want to enter into essential relations with each other. This is from Victor Turner's Pilgrimage and Communitas. He's talking about Sir Richard Burton, who came to Utah back in the 1860s. It's in his book, City of the Saints. Vaughn Brody wrote the introduction and talks about his experiences here. He also became famous because he was the only infidel to be able to work his way into the main Islamic pilgrimage site, Mecca, dressed up as a whirling dervish, and was able to trick his way in there. But this is what he says about the experience. How few have looked upon the celebrated shrine. I may truly say that of all the worshippers who clung weeping to the curtain, who pressed their beating hearts to the stone, none felt for the moment a deeper emotion than it did the Haji from the far north. He's talking about himself. It was as if the poetical legends of the Arabs spoke truth, and that the waving wings of angels, not the sweet breeze of morning, were agitating and swelling the black covering of the shrine. But to confess humbling truth, theirs was the high feeling of religious enthusiasm, and he says mine was only the ecstasy of gratified pride. Turner goes on to say, in my view, his true feeling is in his metaphors rather than in his hubristic confession. This is borne out by the spontaneous sympathy a month earlier with the deeply stirred pilgrims when they first saw their other holy city, Medina. Then Burton had written, for some minutes, my enthusiasm rose as high as theirs. One reverses the evaluative signs from negative to positive. What Burton experienced at the Sacred Kaaba, the navel of the world, set in the mother of cities, to use Muslim metaphors. For it is not so different as it at first sight appears from the more recent account of Malcolm X. I won't read the entire account by Malcolm X. Malcolm X went to Al-Kaaba in 1966, and he describes his feeling of community with others there as going beyond simply as overcoming his prejudices against whites. He was there with, he talks about being there with blonde-haired, blue-eyed, white-skinned people, and feeling, because of being in that place, being thrown together with that common symbol, feeling the prejudices that he had held, the walls that barred him from any kind of community with those people as disintegrated. I could see from this is quoting Malcolm X, I could see from this that perhaps if white America could accept the oneness of God, then perhaps too they could accept in reality the oneness of man and cease to measure and hinder and harm others in terms of their differences of color. What I'm arguing here is that community doesn't require the kind of things that Mr. Mullen seems to think it does. The only thing that is required in community is what Mr. Mullen asserted at the beginning of his paper, is other people. And we go to the ward to, and if we withhold ourselves from those other people, if we withhold ourselves from participation in the church, we see ourselves as Mormon intellectuals and then somehow withhold ourselves from the other, you know, more common folk who are there, we can never experience a community with them. This idea of community, I think, is something that exists apart from the structure, although it requires a structure. Turner speaks of structure and anti-structure in relationship to community. As I said with Bergson, I mean with Martin Buber, the idea of community is something that can arise, the experience of community is something that can arise anywhere, in any situation. It's a decision that we make to enter into community with other human beings. So community is this kind of anti-structural element that can happen at any moment. But in another sense, it requires the structure. As I tried to show in the examples of pilgrimage at the Sacred Kaaba, and you could go on giving 100 other examples of this, talking about Catholic pilgrimages to relic sites, Hindu pilgrimages to temples and relic sites, Mormon experiences in the temple, is that the common symbol preserves the experience that we have of community with other people. And without that symbol, we will eventually lose the unstructured element. So there is an essential tension here that I think Mr. Mullen has also appreciated, that there is an essential tension between the unstructured communities we experience in the ward and the structured form of the church. What I would argue is that they're absolutely essential to each other, and that the one can never completely destroy the other if we ourselves remain open to community with other people. Indeed, I think this is the meaning of those kind of statements that are so often quoted. Mr. Mullen quotes them too, in talking about the glory of God is his intelligence. If you look in that passage closely, section 93, you get an idea. It says that man was in the beginning with God, not talking about man as so much as individual beings, but as first the first principle. or light and truth, that man is light and truth. This goes along with the statement in the Pearl of Great Price that the glory of God is to bring to pass the eternal life, the immortality and eternal life of man. So what, under this kind of an understanding, intelligence is the deepening of our relationships with each other and with God. Indeed, this is the way I would take King Benjamin's statement, that when you are in the service or in relation with your fellow man, you are also in the service of your God.